The following Dharma talk was given by Danika Shoang Ankele Osho at Zen Mountain Monastery. Shoan Osho is a Dharma holder and priest in the Mountains and Rivers Order. This talk, like all of our talks, is offered freely. If you would like to make a donation or find out more about our various programs, visit us online at zmm.org. Thanks for listening.
Good morning, noble friends, and good morning to everyone joining from home or at a distance. Shugen Roshi is in New Zealand, working and teaching the Sangha in New Zealand. So it's my pleasure and anxiety to be sharing this Dharma talk with you this morning. So I have this little verse that I made up for myself that goes like this. If I'm caught in a box, then I made the box. Or I borrowed your box and I climbed inside. We just did a weekend session, and I was thinking about, I was having breakfast and talking a little about like the weekend session, and then later I was remembering, I used to really struggle with weekend sessions because it's like the first day of session, which if you've done a session a whole week, the first day is like totally the worst and the hardest. And so we tell people, if you're just starting, just come for a weekend, and then they get to come and experience the worst possible experience of session. So if you had a lousy weekend, please don't be deterred. And if you had a great weekend, just think about how much better it could be. Don't think about how much better could be, actually, because that is a sure recipe for having a terrible experience the next time around, okay? But as coming out of that, and really reflecting on this aspect of our training, which is these moments of just like total ordinary, and these moments of like so lofty or sacred. You know, it's like just do what you're doing while you're doing it, right? That practice instruction. And then also like you alone between heaven and earth are the honored one. You know, or just each breath completely present, and also the whole universe in the 10 directions is one bright pearl. How does it work? How does it work? Why is it that just doing what we're doing while we're doing it, or being completely present with our breath, is the practice, is the training to realize the whole world universe in the 10 directions is one bright pearl. So I wanted to wade into that question a little bit. Why does it work? Because the whole universe in the 10 directions is one bright pearl. Because we are the ones who are creating the boxes and climbing inside. Because we're the ones who are using our mind in such a way that we're creating categories and separation, just swimming in our opinions and judgments and preferences, totally hooked in concept, but not recognizing that. And we train with that instruction to be present just with one thing so that we have this opportunity to notice that most of the time we're totally not present with one thing. Most of the time the mind is completely divided. Gokhan was imitating me giving a talk the other day. He said that I always am flipping through my pages trying to find the right thing, and he's right. Here it is. Lin Qi, from the record of Master Lin Qi, a 7th century Chinese master and one of the great masters of Zen. In response to the question of what is the devil, said a moment of doubt in the mind is a devil. If you realize all things are unborn and mind is like an illusory projection, so that there is no longer a single particle, a single phenomenon, but everywhere is immaculate purity, this is Buddha. So doing one thing completely, right? That's the instruction. Really put yourself into it. We have this possibility of recognizing, oh, when I'm not divided, when that devil of discursive thought or conceptual meaning-making mind isn't sort of in active duty, then immaculate purity, then Buddha mind. And training works such that we can have experiences and glimpses, and this encourages, I think, our practice to continue, because it's unmistakable, it's recognizable as true and real, and so we can hang in there with practice and start to like actually see what's going on. What is going on? In his talk yesterday, Gokhan was drawing from Bodhidharma, one of the really early teachings of the Zen school. And this is a passage that's attributed to Huika, who was his successor. And this is a passage that is not so well known. It's I took it from a book called the Bodhidharma Anthology, which is a translation and commentary on a long scroll that was found in the Dongguang Caves. So in northern China, in this desert, at the turn of the century, a Taoist monk who was sort of staying in this temple cave complex discovered behind a painting, it's totally like, why haven't they made a movie about this? discovered like behind a painting, a chamber onto this cave room, this library cave, that had 50,000 Buddhist scrolls all scrolled up. I'm sure that we have not translated all of them, okay? So this is just like a little more than 100 years ago. So many teachings, right? And so scholars have been like going through and finding things, and apparently D.T. Suzuki, the well-known D.T. Suzuki, discovered that, I guess the scrolls got discovered and then sort of sent out, they're in different museums, different libraries, and D.T. Suzuki went maybe looking for this purported scroll by Bodhidharma and found it and translated it, and that is where the two entrances and four practices comes from. And in a version of this called the Long Scroll, there are these other texts. So they're attributed to be around the same time of Bodhidharma, and I don't know, how the attribution is exact, like all the scholarship that's going into it, but this teaching is attributed to Huika. And one of the interesting things about this long scroll is that it's right there in the very sort of beginnings of the Zen tradition, some of the things that became stylistic hallmarks of Zen, such as question and answer, begin to emerge, okay? So a student questioned Huika and about the path of the Dharma, and how is it that the path of the Dharma is also said to be empty? And this is the response. And I'm bringing this out. I'm sort of setting aside that question of the path of the Dharma being empty, and bringing this out really as a teaching on mind and how mind works. Okay. It is as if within your residence there were a great stone in the foreground of the garden. Should you fall asleep on it or sit on it, you would neither be alarmed nor fearful. Suddenly, you get an idea to create an image. You hire someone to paint a Buddha image on it. When your mind creates the interpretation Buddha, then you fear committing a sin and no longer dare to sit on top of it. It is the original stone, but this Buddha interpretation was created by your mind. What is mind like? It is always your mind consciousness brush painting and creating these interpretations. You yourself bring on the anxiety. You yourself bring on the fear. In reality, within the stone, there is neither sin nor merit. Your mind itself creates these interpretations. It is as if someone were to paint the forms of yakshas, ghosts, dragons, and tigers. They themselves paint them, but when they look at them in turn, they themselves get fearful. In the paint, ultimately, there is no locus to be feared. It is always your mind consciousness discriminating and creating these interpretations. This teaching runs so deep. This is a liberating teaching. Even a taste begins to shift our experience. And if we stay there with it, that one bright pearl comes clear. Nirvana is sometimes talked about as unbinding. That ordinary mind, samsaric mind, right? We're bound. We're bound by our habits. We're bound by the three poisons, greed, anger, ignorance. We're bound by the kleshas, afflictive emotion. We're bound by karma, by habit energy. So in practice, we're learning, how do we transform that experience? All of that binding is the activity of mind. It's the grasping quality of mind. And we can see in a simple moment that grasping energy, and we should take note and study it and become familiar with it, because it's that energy on subtler and subtler and subtler levels that are creating our sense of self and other, which in some ways is a beautiful experience, but more beautiful when we're not bound by it, when we're free inside of it. Non-grasping. This is the heart of practice. Every part of Zazen practice is trying to give us entry into non-grasping. That instruction on being present with your direct experience of the breath, seeing the thought, letting it go, and coming back to the breath is like a foundational teaching on non-grasping. Grossest level, we're working with like, okay, and you know, right? It's crazy when you sit down with your own mind to see like, whoa, thought, we're pulled again and again and again. It feels like we're pulled. It takes quite a while, I think, for me, to quiet the mind enough to see that it's not so much that we're pulled, but we're grasping, grasping, We're shoring up our sense of ourself. We're in the flow of our habit energy. And each time that we come back, each time that we let go, something's happening in our mind stream. That's why practice changes your experience of your life over time. You're training your mind. Your mind is learning how to let go, how to relax, how to relax. It's hard to see. It's hard to see, but when that ordinary mind meaning the mind that doesn't grasp, that's just whole, relaxed and open, perceiving but not bound by perception. When that mind has a chance to blossom through, those are the moments where we hear the crow and it's like so beautiful, it goes all the way through us, right? Or you have that like bite of fruit salad and it's like, how did they make this? I've shared this before, but I really, there was a time, there was a student who at the beginning of their practice did sesshin and afterwards came to me and was literally like, how do they make the fruit salad? And I was like, it's fruit salad, they cut up the fruit. And he was like, oh my God, really? Because that was like the most incredible thing I've ever eaten. Mind, that's all. Directly encountering itself. Her Eminence Jetsun Khandro Rinpoche teaches, from a Buddhist perspective, enlightenment is freedom from concepts and elaboration. To see the emptiness of concepts and elaboration is why we meditate. So these concepts, we say concept, and it's hard, I think, to recognize just like how much that's actually holding of our experience. Which again is why we train in like, just do this one thing. Keep it simple. Simple work practice. Cleaning. Simple, it's for you. You know, that training and starting to recognize what concepts, like what's meant by that word, what that word is pointing to in terms of mind and experience, this is really an important part of Zen training. It's an important part of working with a teacher. Most of my practice has been with koan study, and I feel like a huge portion of that has been like getting tangled up in subtler and subtler forms of conceptual mind and having my teacher be like, that's an idea, that's an idea, that's an idea, that's an idea. We're starting to recognize. So it's like there is conventional truth, right? There is conventional reality. If we go outside and point to what we call a tree, it's correct to call it a tree, but that's a concept. That's a concept. Where is the tree? It's in our mind. What's right in front of us is not a tree. I know that there are folks working on Mu, which is excellent. And Mu is like a concept burning practice. And I mean, I feel like I really wouldn't want to relive my experience of practicing with Mu because it was so just like being thrown again and again against something I couldn't see, but just like feeling the impact, feeling the impact, feeling the impact. And I don't work with people on koans at this point, but, you know, sometimes people will come in, and one time someone came in and said, you know, my name is such and such and my practice is Mu, and I think I figured it out. And I was like, oh, I wish I had a bell right now. You can't figure it out. That's like the first sign of conceptual mind. Yeah, so all of you working on Mu, my heart goes out to you. Yeah. So the ordinary moments, coming into here and now, always here and now, anything other than here and now is conceptual, right? The past doesn't exist. The future doesn't exist. As soon as we say the present, it's not the present. It doesn't exist. Here, now, here, now. Not an idea. Opening to feeling, to sensation, to emotion. Dropping out of conceptual thinking mind into the body. These are all really excellent ways of training and being intimate with your experience. And then we have all of these forms and practices within our tradition that are pointers. Every service that we do, bows, prostrations, offerings. Every time that we talk about all sentient beings, all Buddhas throughout space and time, that's the one bright pearl. So it's a reminder, but not to think about it. Just like, oh, all Buddhas. I was reading this memoir by Helen Twerkov. She's the founding editor of Tricycle Magazine, and she has now she's in her early 80s, and she has a memoir called Lotus Girl, My Life at the Crossroads of Buddhism and America. And it was a great read. I recommend it. I told someone it's sort of like a monastic version of a beach read. And sprinkled throughout are some of her recollections of encounters that she had with different teachers. She practiced in Vajrayana for a bit and also Zen for a bit and studied actually for quite some years with Maizumi Roshi, who's in our lineage. And she told this story about working with the Tibetan teacher Thinley Norbu. And I guess this is like in the 70s. They were, you know, someone got some property together and they were having a retreat, you know, sort of one of these like make it happen. And Thinley Norbu was the teacher. And she writes, Thinley Norbu instigated various tag team games and delighted in witnessing the masks of constructed personas get cracked open by physical exertion. Then he would remind us, watch your mind. That was always Thinley Norbu's instruction, and he would use any situation, anywhere, and any time in an attempt to introduce us to ourselves. Like other students, I sometimes received these lessons in late evening phone calls, and like this wouldn't fly today, but in the 70s is a different time. I might pick up the phone to the sound of his crooning compliments. I would take pleasure and pride in his descriptions of my silky hair and diamond eyes. Then, once I was hooked, I would hear, only one problem. You are so fat. Total deflation. Up, down, then watch your mind. So intense. If you release any like judgment you have might have about that style of teaching, just that like total that total setup. Watch your mind. On other occasions, Thinley Norbu might question me about a Dharma text or principle, and then he would say, "You have really good understanding. You are so smart. You are my most intelligent student." And then it would turn out I was actually the dumbest person he had ever met. Watch your mind. Do you understand? We're the one getting hooked. We're the one grabbing on. Compliments, praise. I'm great. You don't like it? Oh, no. Oh. It's so hard to see because it feels like, it's like Diderot, she would always teach, only you can make you angry. This is like such a difficult teaching. Still, I'm like, yeah? But if you really watch, you see. Such a difficult teaching. Helen Twerkov says, watch your mind, then what? Take responsibility for it. Responsibility for my mind. What did that look like? And she writes about how she was like a responsible person in so many ways, but this teaching about taking responsibility for her mind was confounding. What does it mean to take responsibility? It's my mind. It's my reaction. It's an edgy teaching too, right? Because like, you can do something that like would hurt me. So we have the teaching of the relative and the teaching of the absolute. And the teaching is that they're non-dual. So you can do something that would hurt me. I could do something that would hurt you. And then I would need to take responsibility for that. Have to really be awake. Have to really be awake. And committed to freeing ourselves. Divesting in our own self-creation. Recognizing what's actually going on, energy, karma, experience, it's not actually tethered to a separate self. So when I create harm, can I freely admit it? I am so sorry. I am so sorry. When I'm the one in pain, how do I work to recognize how I might be perpetuating that pain, to feel pain and let it move through, to take care of and do my healing work. So important. And we've probably all been there where we're grasping at our own suffering, identified somehow with our own pain, invested samsara, keeping it going. Really hard. You can see why the Buddha said, I don't know if I'm going to teach. It's so subtle. Will people be able to understand? There's the Gatha of Atonement, right? Our translation, all evil karma ever committed by me since of old, on account of my beginningless greed, anger, and ignorance, born of my body, mouth, and thought. Now I atone for it all. And we can see that as, you know, when we breach the precepts and act in harmful ways, it's an opportunity to reflect and take responsibility. And then there's like the deeper level, which is like, I am a sentient being with conditioning in which I believe myself to be separate, needing to defend and protect. Always I'm acting from this mistaken view, or almost always. Always subtle rupture, distance, forms and flavors of aversion that I'm acting out of, that I'm creating. I recognize this. May I be awake. May I be awake. May I turn this habit. I vow to turn my mind. And this is edgy too, because on the one hand, we do want to be free of our suffering. And a path that shows us how to do that may seem like, yeah, that is what I'm looking for. But then on the other hand, we want to hold on to our identity, right? We want to hold on to my sense of myself. It's hard to see. It's like we want both freedom and all my opinions and judgments. Freedom and my fantasies. Can I have liberation on my terms? No. Then it's not freedom. You're bound. You're still bound. I think sometimes, oh, yes, we want to wake up and we're scared. We want to be free, but maybe not totally free. Just free enough. And sometimes we practice like that. Sometimes we really practice like that. I definitely recognize that in myself. Like wanting to hover around those habits and pull them over me. It's like a blanket. The winds of emptiness are too sharp, too cool. Give me some of my suffering. It's cozy, weirdly cozy. This is why Bodhisattva vow is so important. Expanding our view and our reference. Sort of, it's like so much of practice is woven through, right? I was saying the presence of sort of all those other beings, right? When we do the meal gatha, which we'll do again before lunch, there's like the gratitude, and then there's like the dedication, right? First, this food is for the three treasures. Second, it's for our teachers, parents, nations, and all sentient beings. Third, it's for all beings in the six realms. Thus, we eat this food with everyone. We eat to stop all evil, to practice good, to save all sentient beings, and to accomplish our Buddha way, to realize the one bright pearl. So the brush that we're painting our experience with, this brush of mind, to recognize that that's what's happening. Hard to see. Hard to see. The teaching is like when there is suffering, we're painting with that brush. Hard teaching. But that's why liberation is possible. That's why you don't have to wait for someone else to come and save you. It's totally in our hands. And we're not alone. We're so connected. Practicing together makes such a big difference in so many ways. And to appreciate that all of those simple, simple, concrete, practical practices that we do are offering a point of entry, and all of those lofty, sort of expansive, you know, services to deities and dharma protectors are reminding us of this much vaster view. Both things. I've been thinking about this. The monastics have had a couple conversations about ordination and what does it mean to ordain. And that's just been present for me. And thinking about like the sort of the practical pieces of that, as I was working on this talk, you know, we were talking the other day, when you ordain in this order, it means you live your life here. You're serving this sangha, these teachers, following the schedule. It's like very practical, leading meal crews, helping with the bookkeeping, you know, the day-to-day, making the monastery happen. And then there's that extraordinary part. No one becomes a monk to lead a meal crew. I'll just put it that way. That part of the life here, which is maintaining the Dharma, maintaining the space for the Sangha to gather, so that the one bright pearl can be discovered and manifested. If I'm caught in a box, then I made the box. Or I borrowed your box and I climbed inside. With four walls and a floor, I like it in here. I know who I am. I'm wrapped in my fear. My fear keeps me warm. My hate keeps me safe. I don't want to get out. I like how things chafe. If I'm caught in a box, then I made the box. Or I borrowed your box and I climbed inside. Though this box isn't real, I don't want to let go. I keep making it up. I believe it. I know. Now, I feel it dissolving. When I start to relax, there's no need to resist as it bends and it cracks. I learn I can open and be with what's here. The box isn't real. The walls disappear. And I'm flying, unbound, through empty, clear space, with sensation and feeling arising as grace. And all of the beings, not quite me, not quite you, we're all one great body. I don't know. It's true. If I'm caught in a box, then I made the box. And who needs a box when the air is so clear?
Thanks so much for listening. For meditation supplies such as cushions, incense, liturgical instruments, Dharma books, and more, visit monasterystore.org. Support for your spiritual practice at home.